and welcome to another episode of Fool's Daily. I'm still joined by Lee.
Hello.
And I'm still joined by Justin.
Hello.
Continuing our conversation from the last episode, today we are going to talk about something that will be of great interest to many of our listeners, and that is the new organized play rules for 2015. Gaining Grounds 2015. I don't know whether... I'm not sure whether it will actually be out when people listen to this. Justin, do you know when it's actually going to be released?
I believe the plan was sometime this month, but I don't have an exact date.
Okay, so Lee and I have seen it.
Yep.
Part of the advantage of being henchmen is that you get to see it early so you can plan for next year. What were your sort of aims with it this year, Justin? And how is it different from 2014?
Well, the key difference is there are five new strategies in it, just sort of change up the play. That's the big thing. Other than that, I can't think of any major change. There's some minor language cleanup. I think we might have extended round times, fixed a few typos. But yeah, the big thing is the... five new strategies, and the goal was to just add some variance to play. We wanted to look back on the year, see what worked, see what didn't, and change accordingly. Originally, actually, we wanted to take out the schedule, the rotating strategies that had been in 2014, but once we put that into playtest, apparently the henchmen had really enjoyed that aspect, so we put it back in. Which leaves the only major change as the extra strategies.
Okay. Yes, that was the bane of my life at the weekend, that rotating strategy, because it meant we played Stake Claim twice.
Well, that's what you get for playing Kirai.
It was fine the first game. The second time we played it, when I was up against two Insidious Madnesses and two Silurids, there was no way I was getting any claim points.
That's a tough one.
Reza models with leap, Justin. No, oh, not Reza models. Guild models with leap.
Oh, I was about to say, I can think of at least one.
Yeah, but it's not far enough for stake of claim. Yeah. It's only 6 inches. It needs to be 7 inches. So a jet-propelled Necropunk, that's what we need.
Or you could just take a Silurid.
I can't take them in the Reza.
I'll take something else then. Wonder how many...
All right, so...
Sorry.
No, I'm trying to get us back on track.
Oh.
So, five new strats, Justin. What have we got as our five strats?
Oh, I should have opened it. So let's see. we changed some of the names. We had one we called Tug of War. Do you guys remember what we changed the name to?
Yeah. Is it not Headhunter or something now?
No, that's one of the other ones.
No, the one I've just opened. The one I've just opened. It's still called Tug of War.
All right, I'll go open it really quickly. So, in what was previously Tug of War, or what...
the strategy formerly known as Tug of War.
It's a lot like Turf War in that there's a single marker in the center, and if you have at least two models within 6 inches, you score a point at the end of every turn after the first. But the key difference is if you have the most models within 6 inches, then you get to move it 3 inches. Just a little subtle change that... really sort of changes up how you're going to think about it and how you're going to play. And you can see why it was called Tug of War. Yeah. Let's see here. Where's Gaining Grounds? I can't find it. Oh, well. And then we have Headhunter, which is a really interesting new one. Whenever a model is killed, you drop a head marker within 3 inches. And then any model... in base contact, can make a one interact to pick it up, and at the end of every turn after the first, if your crew has picked up at least one head marker, you get a victory point. And it's worth noting that you can pick up head markers from either crew. So if they snipe you from across the board, and you run and pick up the head marker of your own guy first, then you get the point. So that really puts an interesting dynamic in play. You don't want to just sit way back and shoot at them. You want to like get up close. It makes things like companion and accomplice really important to come grab that marker before your opponent can. All sorts of crazy things that I did not think would work, but playtesting it, it worked, and it was very cool.
It's my favorite one, I think.
Yeah, it's a good one. Actually, James Doxey came up with that one, so credit where credit was due. Actually, all the moderators, Adrian Scott, Mason Crawford, worked on these, so I can't sit and take all the credit. And then Aaron Darlin is putting it together. Really, I have done the least amount of work on this, so I don't... That's not true.
Extraction is the new name for Tug of War.
Extraction. Okay, that's right. And you have like a hostage marker you're trying to get out of there or something. Yes. Something a little bit
more. An informant marker at the center of the table.
Something a little bit more serious. I like Tug of War.
I liked Tug of War as well, I must admit. But then I liked the t-shirts that were made for Gen Con, which probably makes me a bad person. So.
Oh, those. Yeah.
I missed something here? T-shirts? Have I got to go and look it up?
Yeah, I would just go and look it up, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've got Extraction, Headhunter.
And then one was called, I believe, Interference.
Yeah.
Which is a modified reconnoiter. Aha, I have found the new document. It is opening, but it is a modified reconnoiter, and the key difference is that engaged models do not count for scoring a quarter.
Yeah, and that it sounds like you first read it and you think, oh, it's just recon, but that one change completely changes the game dynamic.
Yeah, totally. I mean, because then you have to think of, you know, basically, you really have to think, am I trying to contest this quarter, or like, am I trying to score it? Do I want my models in combat to tie him up because he has more stuff than me? Do I want them out to try to score? And then it increases the value of models with longer engagement ranges because then they can come and occupy multiple models. All sorts of cool stuff that on first read you don't see. And that
well, it also it makes the center of the board interesting. In recon, you just stay out of that 6-inch area of the center of the board.
Mm-hmm.
But in interference, you can put, if you're trying to engage with people, you can have your engaging models within that 6 inches because obviously they won't score anyway.
Right.
And I saw an interesting case. We were playing recon at the weekend, and there was an interesting case where actually, if it had been interference, it would have been very interesting because he had a lot of models with 3-inch engagement ranges, and so it was one of those cases that my model, I can't hit you, but you could hit me, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But both models, of course, count as engaged, so neither would score. So being quite a distance away, but you were still locking that model down.
Yeah. So it's a cool change. I'm a fan. And I think Adrian Scott came up with that one. And Extraction as well. I probably should stop giving credit because then I'm going to forget somebody and they're going to get mad at me.
Well, no, I do. You were right with James and Headhunter. So I knew that one, but I don't know the others. And Guard the Stash?
And Guard the Stash. Let's see here. That one, you place 2 50-millimeter stash markers, height 5, blocking, impassable, hardcover. If you can't tell, I found the document, so I get to just read it. on the center line, each 5 inches on either side of the center of the board, 10 inches apart from each other. So basically, you have these two big 50-millimeter markers on the center line of the board. And at the end of every turn, after the first, you get 1 VP if you have a model within 2 inches of each marker. Which I believe I came up with this one, or at least like sort of amalgamated it from other people's ideas. And so it's slightly different. It's a typical, you know, control the points objective. But having to stay split up makes that a little bit more interesting. You get lots of, you know, cool push-pull effects that are very valuable there. Also, because the markers actually block line of sight, you could have sort of like a, you know, end up chasing each other around. It actually changes the line of sight, sort of some of the dynamics of the board. So, yeah, that's another one.
Yeah, and then the joke. So those are on the normal cards, and then we've got the Joker's strat is collect the bounty, which I found very confusing the first time I read it, I must admit, but actually works out really interestingly, because it's a killing one, but you don't want to kill too much so that you leave it with yourself with other models to kill next turn.
Yeah, it's sort of the replacement for Reckoning. And how it works is whenever you kill enemy models, you score bounty points. Peons are 0, minions are 1, enforcers are 2, henchmen are 3, and masters are 4, unsurprisingly. And so if you have the most bounty points at the end of a turn after the first, you score 1 VP. And then the next turn, your bounty points reset to 0, so you have to kill more stuff again. And then if your opponent is totally wiped out, then you score VP, just like in Recon. So yeah.
Yes, and it's also asymmetrical as well, and that only one person can score the points, the same as stake claim.
Right. I should have mentioned that. Yeah, the Joker strategies, I think we're sticking to a theme of the Joker is asymmetrical.
Which is quite interesting. It's also interesting because it makes Miranda's standard "I shall run up and then turn into a thing" trick not a good one, because you get because your opponent gets the points for her being because she's sacrificed.
Does do they? Let me read the
fine. Yeah, whenever an enemy model is killed or sacrificed.
The acting model's controller. So in that case, Miranda would be the acting model. And she would not be an enemy. So nobody would score points.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
See? I have to read things. bloody games designers.
Yeah.
Reading stuff with us.
Yeah, I should... Yeah, it's probably worth putting a little example in there or something.
So that's pretty good. I mean, I guess with all these things, it's up to TOs, but the plan is to for TOs to be able to just mix and match between these and the classic strats.
Right. So the new rotation, which we put back in by popular demand, includes both old and new, which I like because you have something familiar and then something that you're getting used to as you play out the year. And it also means you don't end up playing the same thing twice, no matter how many rounds you go. Well, I guess if you went 11 rounds, then you would, but I have never heard of that.
No, 7 is the most that I've ever done. So
yeah, 7, a 2-day event that goes 7 isn't uncommon. But yeah, anything over that. Anyway, so yeah, it means that you don't have to play them twice. They got put into the rotation. And if you don't want to use a rotation, you just want to pick, you know, whatever, now you have 10 things to choose from. Also, you know, I think we mentioned that Collect the Bounty was the Joker, but they all have a suit associated with them, just like the original table. So if you just wanted between you and your friends to play a friendly game and just flip, or if the TO wanted to determine randomly and flip, that mechanic is there as well.
Cool. So, I mean, is it your thought going forward that we'll get more... schemes as well, or
no? I think I am of the opinion we have enough for the moment. Also, with the way that scheme pools work, it would be much harder to put in a tournament setting. It's easier because the TO can just set the scheme pool for every round. But as we add things, I do want them to work for friendly play as well as tournaments, even in the case of the Gaining Grounds document, right? Like, you could just say, hey, let's play Interference, and it works. But if we add, like, 6 new schemes, I don't know how you would add that to a friendly game. And also, we have, how many schemes do we have? 13, 17, 18 schemes?
Something like that, yeah.
19 schemes. I think we have 19 schemes. So I'm of the opinion we have plenty. that isn't to say we won't ever add new ones. I just don't have plans for it at the moment.
That's true. Because cool. You can always sort of do it that you do two tables and flip the first card red or black, depending on which table you flip from there, couldn't you?
You could. Absolutely, you could. Although I would need 19 more schemes.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And but yeah, that's a possibility.
So these strats are gaining grounds, which obviously is a document that goes in and out of currency,
mm-hmm.
as you will. Is it the plan that these strats will be strats forever, or are they really, you know, is it for 2015 and then 2016 they go away, or can players sort of think, okay, there's always now 10 strats
That
we'll be able to choose from.
Depends entirely on their popularity. If it turns out everybody just, you know, hates Guard the Stash, I think you could pretty well expect to see that go away in 2016, just as an example. But if everybody likes all of them, or at least tolerate, because not everybody's going to like all of them, but, you know, as long as they are generally well-liked, I think that we would likely keep them, maybe tweak anything we felt was unbalanced that showed up over the course of the year, and then just add to it. So the current plan is to add to it, because I don't think we screwed these up, otherwise we wouldn't be putting them out. But I'll let the players decide that.
Cool.
One other thing I've seen in Gaining Grounds, and I can't tell you if it's in the last one or not, is it new this year, the number of rounds for attendees to the number of rounds?
I don't think so.
I think that was in last year as well.
Oh, right, okay. I'll shut up then. I'll sit quietly in the corner. Just brag to Spooner that when I speak to him next, I can clang.
Well, that you can now name drop that you've talked to Justin?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's all right. It's okay. It says that we only need to do 5 rounds for the GT next year. 33 plus.
That's just where we stopped counting.
Seven rounds we're going to do. We're doing next year. Over 2 days. Oh.
It'll be fine. We'll have.
It's okay. I'm segueing. You'll like this. So, we just ran the GT here, Justin. 66 players. We're aiming for 100 players. And then you went and made Nova Open the US National Championships.
We did.
So, you and I had a quick conversation. And we're safe to announce this, aren't we?
I think so.
Cool. Yeah. So, next year's UK GT isn't going to be the UK GT anymore. It's going to be the official weird UK National Championships. Is that right?
That is correct.
Woohoo!
Yay.
I don't think actually makes any difference.
I don't think it does.
It sounds better.
It does. It sounds cool. I'm going to have some banners made. But it does mean that we will be doing invitations, or effectively golden tickets is what I've been thinking of them as, that you'll be able to win at various tournaments throughout the year next year. But we don't know what they are going to be yet.
Yep.
But that's quite cool.
I think that's very exciting. I think it's a cool system. Just the idea of, you know, qualifying for this bigger championship, I think is really neat. Nova in the States it's a little different here just because we're so spread out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's very different. There's just these large areas of land in between. Like, so far as I'm concerned, you know, New York may as well be UK. Like, I cannot go there. It is too far away.
Right? Well, exactly. I mean, it's the same. It's the same distance. We're as far away from New York as you are.
Yeah.
As you are.
Yeah,
where you are.
Exactly. So, you know, in the U.S. National Championship is a little bit different thing, I think. But, you know, that's not what we're talking about right now. I think in terms of doing it for the UK, I think it's really cool. I just think it'll be a fun thing to have, you know, these golden tickets. It'll add some popularity to the events that are giving them out. I think even probably more so than to the GT itself, right? Because that's already pretty popular, but it means you get to kind of spread that popularity to other events that you deem worthy throughout the year, which would be pretty cool.
Yeah, and then my current thought is that I'm going to, you know, there is a group, you know, there's effectively a group of TOs in the UK that are organizing all of the events. So my plan is that each TO will get a ticket that they can use at what they consider to be their premier event.
Mm-hmm.
For that sort of thing. But it is interesting. I mean, Malifaux as a hobby seems to be going from strength to strength. I was looking at some stats yesterday because we were putting together the stuff for our Masters event in January. And we had, at tournaments, we had 299 unique players in 2014. And we had 44 events. I mean, that's almost one every weekend.
That's pretty cool.
I mean, is your impression that that Malifaux is growing as a hobby, and, you know, cementing its position in the pantheon of games?
Yes, I mean, so far as I can tell, it is. I don't really have access to the sales numbers, which I think would be a big factor in that. But, you know, I've seen more buzz around it. I've seen a good progression of the competitive scene, which I think is sort of your next step as a game, you know? And so, yeah, I think it's on its way. And I think cementing good, solid, competitive play is a large part of the next step.
And does it give you a thrill as the designer of the game to see all these people playing your game?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love it. You know, I've loved it since the start. I mean, I started as a fan, right? Like, I started playing it. So it's cool to share this with the community. You know, that's what it's all about.
So we said last episode that we were going to sort of put you on the spot and have you look back, and if you could change things, what would you change? So I hope you've been thinking.
Oh, I've been thinking for quite a while.
All right. So if you could go back in time, not that far really, because, you know, second edition is what, a year and a half old?
Yeah, about a year and a half.
what would you tell your previous game designer self to know? Go, no, don't do that.
Yeah. From a game design perspective.
Or game design or models or, I mean, anything really.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got a number of things. One area of the rules that is always a little bit contentious is line of sight in terms of vertical distances and height, and how that works with the vantage point rule, in particular, but also just, you know, attacking models that are in different heights and blah, blah, blah. And that's an area we get a lot of questions about. And I have spent a lot of time thinking about how we would simplify it. And something Mac Martin used to always say was that line of sight rules are nearly impossible to write because you're trying to put into language something that people understand so intuitively that if you don't meet their expectations exactly, they're going to rebel against it. So, for example, if you write these abstract line of sight rules, which is what we have, and you have two models on the board, and, you know, one's a giant hulking monster and its head is clearly above this building, but the building is technically height 5 and the monster's technically height 4, and people are going to be like, well, I can see it. Like, I can see it with my eyes that I'm using right now. What are these rules to tell me I can't see it? So, due to that intuition, I think line of sight rules are very difficult to write, particularly in regards to changing elevations, right? Because you're going from what is a 2D system into a 3D system, which is entirely different. And, you know, the vantage point has had a lot of criticism, but, you know, to be blunt, doing it better is very difficult, if not impossible. I mean, if you look back at the 1.5 rules and you look at the shadow rule, and you just read that text, that is a very difficult rule to understand. And I have sympathy for the people who had to put that rule down because I know how hard it is. So anyway, here's what I would change. Here's what I would do. I said this on another podcast too recently. I would get rid of elevation, period. I would say you cannot go on top of the building. Full stop. And just, this is a 2D game. And avoid that set of rules completely. Use the line of sight rules we have for two dimensions, and then you just cannot go on top of stuff. And I don't think it would be that big of a detriment to the game, because climbing is so difficult and takes so much time that people rarely take advantage of it. So the two big situations where you see models actually on top of stuff is either when they have flight or incorporeal, in which case they are generally using some horrendous advantage, like placing a ski marker where nobody could ever possibly get it, or they have this, like, you know, 10-foot tall tower in the deployment zone, and they put their sniper on the top of it and nobody can ever get to it. And I would have no qualms with both of those interactions disappearing from the game and simplifying it along the way. You know, that said, I'm sure you could point out individual situations in which having multiple elevations was very cool, or boards you can build. And while I get that, I think that both the rules abuse and the simplicity would be well worth it.
Wow. That, I was not expecting that at all. Blimey. That would be a very brave games designer decision, really, wouldn't it? I mean, it's not something you would normally expect a games designer to say, is, oh yes, we're just going to make it a two-dimensional game. Wow. Cool.
It'd take a lot of the sort of debate and stuff out. I know we were at an event on Sunday, and there was quite a lot of, well, can he see him while he's standing on the walkway? Well, yes, because you're this, and this. And in the end, it was, you know, it was a rules book out, have a look, read through quickly and confirm. But I know that's the only time I've sort of stopped, you know, sort of mid-game to look at that kind of thing.
No, I'm quite shocked at that, honestly. I thought halfway through that conversation you were going to advocate going through to a true line of sight system, which, you know, given that the majority of players use Malifaux with the models that are designed by Weird, you know, could work. But then you do have interesting things with, you know, height one effigies that are actually height, you know, that are giant.
Yeah. True line of sight has, you know, a lot of people love it, a lot of people hate it. It has its ups and it has its downs. And I would have no qualms with using it in general, in a system in general, but I don't personally think it would be the right fit for Malifaux. First, because our models are generally so dynamic, like you have Mayfang literally standing on top of a bunch of boards, right? So
yeah,
it's easier to shoot her because of the base insert she got. And the Malifaux models have been designed basically from the first with the idea that they could be as dynamic as we wanted and it's not going to affect gameplay. You know, if we didn't have years of that backlog model design philosophy, I might be singing a different tune there. The other reason is I think an abstract system is much, much, much better for competitive play, which I think is very important for driving interest forward.
Yeah, that's very cool. And how about a model that you would change? Or that you would tell your younger self to... Certainly slightly younger, I should say.
Well, anything I ratted...
Well, yeah, so, well, okay, we can take that as red, I think.
See, now this is dangerous territory, right?
Like, people are going to say, oh, Justin thinks this
like ripping out all of the line of sight rules, everyone's going to be like, well, that would be interesting, but that's not going to happen. But the second I say, oh, this model should have one less wound, or this model should have one less attack or casting or whatever, everyone's going to be like, aha! okay, I'll say it. Rotten Bells probably should have been casting 7 on Lure. I'm sorry. it's not going to happen. I'm not going to errata it. I'll just say that point blank. I mean,
oh yeah, no.
Assuming that like some huge data point doesn't come out where like you know people always win if they take them. Like, but yeah, if I could go back in time, sure, I'd make them casting seven. I think they'd still be plenty good. But I don't think it's worth an errata because errata comes with lots of issues, like you're outdating older cards, and then we have to reissue the new Arsenal decks. Completely. And I think there is also a huge value in consistency of play. You know, you sit down at a game and you know what a model does, right? Like, that model does this, this, and this, but if I come out with, like, a weekly update patch, which I could, you know, the game is changing week to week and nobody knows what's going on and it gets crazy. So I really have to look at what I absolutely need to change and what I, you know, maybe I could have done differently in the past, but oh well. And then what is working perfectly fine. And, you know, Rotten Bells sit on that middle tier, which, by the way, I use them as an example because they come up all the time. But I think a lot of models sit on that middle tier. So, you know, there it is.
Yeah. Because a lot of the stuff that you have errated hasn't always been through gameplay. I mean, a lot of it's been base size or...
right.
With the two hench for the guild, it was missing the rare one. And
yeah.
So, I mean, there's not massive amount that's really, truly had to be errated so far, is there?
Yeah, there's pretty much three instances where I'll errata a model. Number one is just a blatant typo or a physical change. Basically, like you mentioned, Barbaros came out and his model was too big to fit in his base, so I ratted him to be in a larger base size, right? Because there's no choice there. Samael and Francisco, there was a typo and they didn't get rare one, and that's kind of ridiculous. Yes, they should be rare one, fine. The second is sort of related to the first. It's things that just don't work, right? Like I ratted the Brewmaster's, one of his upgrades, because the wording on it, if you read it, it just one sentence does not logically follow from the next. So I changed it. Basically, it's a typo. And then the third is it's just completely and utterly and hideously broken. And not to the point where, oh, it's a little too good. If I had a time machine, I'd change it, like in the case of the Rotten Bells. But in the sense that it is seriously warping the system, it is having noticeable effects on, let's say, tournament outcomes. When I go to design a new model, I think about it first. Like, how will that new model interact with this? And now I'm, like, weakening an entire faction because they have this one good model or upgrade, and I'm talking about Nexus of Power here. Let's just be honest. Like, I went to start designing Wave 2 stuff, and I'm like, okay, I can't make this too good because of Nexus of Power. I can't make that too good because of Nexus of Power. Like, you know what? It's time to change Nexus of Power. Like, it's just, I'm done. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, the only big ones I can think of was obviously Lynch got his to once a turn. In fact, thinking about it, I can't think of any others other than Nexus.
A couple of upgrades. There was the Ophelia upgrade, wasn't there?
Yes.
Yeah.
That changed, but not very many. And let's face it, you never see Ophelia.
No, not really.
If you see gremlins on the tabletop, you see Summer.
Or Wong.
Or Wong. Because he is. Couldn't you just go back to your younger self and tell him to take the gremlins out of the game again?
No, I like gremlins.
Oh, I forgot that. That slipped my mind.
I think I have a gremlin as my Skype avatar. You should be staring at one right now.
Oh, yes. No, there it is. Bums. Oh, well. Okay. Well, I think that sort of brings us to end. Thank you, as always, for your time, Justin.
Oh, you're welcome. I want to say one more thing.
Oh.
I would also clean up trigger timing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I can see that.
I'm not going to go into details how, because I think we were basically done. But, yes, I would do that.
Cool. Well, thanks very much again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, no problem. Super fun to be here.
And we chat again, I'm sure, as we get into the new year. So until then, I've been Mike.
I've been Lee.
And I've been Justin.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can contact Fools Daily on Twitter, we're at Fools_Daily, or via email, foolsdaily@outlook.com.